Hello and welcome to the Chengdu Gaming Federation podcast. My name is Charlie. I'm joined by Austin.
Hey, what's up?
Today we are recording our third podcast, which is specifically about the Nintendo Entertainment System. This follows up last week's podcast, which was about our five favorite indie games. And we thought we wanted to get into console-specific games, and we thought the NES was a great place to start because this is the beginning of mine, and I think your console history. I mean, really, my game history starts with the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Me as well. As I think I mentioned in our first podcast, my babysitter would come over with it, so that was my first experience with video games.
I had my dad buy one when I was five, and then it took me a year before I could really get into it, understand how to play it. I guess I was a little too young to have it really capture my attention.
Stupid five-year-old.
Yeah, stupid five-year-old. Once I finally got around to it, and I remember playing the first Mario, and I remember my mind being blown in particular getting to the second swimming stage in Mario and being like, whoa, now I'm swimming. What the? And it's just like it really excited me. It was just like a really amazing new medium that I had not experienced before. So recently the NES has been in the news with the NES Classic. This is something we've talked about a lot in the gaming group on WeChat. For those who don't know, I imagine most people listening to this know, the NES Classic is a tiny version of the Nintendo, which was released by Nintendo in November of 2016. So it was actually one of the hottest holiday gift items of the year.
Sold out pretty much everywhere.
This thing was super difficult to get. And I didn't get one. I wanted to get one. Yeah. I would have bought one had I had the opportunity. And I feel like there are thousands, maybe millions of people who wanted to buy this but couldn't get it. And it's been a topic of discussion for a couple months now. But it recently resurfaced in the news last week when it was announced that Nintendo would discontinue the Nintendo Classic.
Good marketing strategy, Nintendo. Everybody wants it. Let's get rid of it.
Yeah, which seems absolutely crazy. I mean, it seems like really just the craziest thing to imagine that they would do that. So it looks like none of us are getting an NES Classic anytime soon. Although someone in the group did say, I think it was Kareem, who said, posted a link rather on Taobao where there are sellers in China selling the NES Classic for, I think, about 1,000 kwai.
Just a relatively reasonable price.
Really reasonable. Yeah. I mean, it costs $60 in the States, and 1,000 RMB is about 150. Yeah. But that's still cheaper. I mean, now it must be $400 or something on eBay, like very expensive.
And bear in mind that we're living in China. The cost of living and everything is much cheaper here. So, I mean, spending 1,000 RMB to get something is not unreasonable for us.
Right. There have been all these media reports about Nintendo, typical crazy Nintendo, by doing this, because Nintendo kind of has this habit of creating an appetite for a certain product and then not delivering it, either not producing enough stock or running into some kind of manufacturing issue or some kind of issue like this, where the demand for the NES Classic is so significant and Nintendo has kind of needed a hit for a long time. And now that they have it, they're like, not available anymore. Ugh. So some of these Nintendo games are much discussed games recently. I know that three of the ones on my list were included with the NES Classic. The NES Classic has flash-based storage, so it included 30 games, and you can't add any more beyond that. But the 30 are kind of regarded as
classics.
Yeah, 30 of the best that you would want for the console. So it's a pretty good package of games, in my opinion.
Yeah.
All right. So let's jump right into our favorite games here. Do you want to go first? For those who didn't listen to our previous podcast, I have a list of my favorite NES games, and Austin has a list of his, and I have not seen his list, and he has not seen mine. So hopefully we'll see some surprises here.
Yeah, I mean, I have a feeling we may have some more overlap here than we did last week. But starting out, one of my favorite games possibly of all time, biggest impact probably on me, was Legend of Zelda. I don't think that's a big surprise coming out of me. I love that series, and that was probably the first game I actually got started on. I, as I said, babysitter would come over, and I would just spend hours on that game. The sense of wonder and joy of exploration, the lack of hand-holding that game had. And it was originally released in 1986 for the Famicom in Japan and did not come out for another few years in America. But it was a bestseller for Nintendo, selling over 6.5 million copies.
That is a huge amount.
Yeah. And it was the first NES title to sell over 1 million. It was reissued in 1992 as part of Nintendo's Classic series. But before that, on its original release in America, most people know it was released as a gold cartridge, which is sought after by many people. And I still have my gold cartridge of that, which I'm super stoked about.
No kidding. That's cool.
Yeah. So one of the things, though, that was pretty, I don't know, I think translates into later Nintendo practice with some of their weird practices with accessories. I did not realize this because it was only on the Japanese release of the game. The Famicom had a microphone, and there were enemies in the game called Pole's Voice that even in the American instruction manual, it says that these can be scared of noise and voices, and people got really confused by the manual, but it was referring to in the Japanese version of the game, you could use the microphone.
There was a microphone on the Famicom?
Yeah, and you could use the microphone to weaken the enemies. Really weird, right?
Where's the microphone? The controller?
I think it was in the controller, yeah.
That is super bizarre. I never even heard that.
Yeah, me neither. Pretty weird. But that did translate to later games in the series on the DS, which obviously had a mic built into the system. So,
I remember being a difficult game. I remember being very young, having not played any RPG. I mean, in general, and Zelda's not really a straight-up RPG. It's kind of action-adventure, exploration, with some RPG elements. But I remember it being really difficult.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a precursor to later RPGs, I think. And did with the overworld and a lot of those elements did translate into games like, say, Dragon Quest or Final Fantasy. And but according to Miyamoto, those in Japan during testing were confused and had trouble finding their way through multiple paths and dungeons. It was not an easy game for most people. And Miyamoto actually encouraged people to talk about it and to communicate about the game and share.
Was that a Miyamoto game?
It was.
Shigeru Miyamoto, yeah, the most famous Nintendo game legend, designer. The godfather.
But one of the things that they did with the release of it in America was they encouraged people to send in their proof of purchase to become a member of the Fun Club, where members got 4, 8, and eventually a 32-page newsletter. And this eventually turned into Nintendo Power. And,
oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and this was, you know, the big deal about that was back then, you know, you wanted to get the tips and tricks and the secrets.
I was thinking Fun Club, that does not have the ring that Nintendo Power has. Yeah, I remember that hotlines were like a big thing at the time too, like for people who get stuck in Zelda, like call the hotline, and then they would have advertisements. Yeah, like you call the number, and there's like a guy sitting at in a cubicle with like an 8-inch TV and like a Nintendo. And he's like, oh, yeah, so like Dungeon 6, you want to like turn left and then kill these three guys, whatever. Really funny to imagine that like pre-internet era.
Yeah. Now things are so different. But that, you know, growing up with games back then,
Someone should bring that back. Stuck in Civilization? Call our Civ hotline. It's like, okay, so Gandhi declared war on you. All right, let's see. I'm turning to the chapter.
Yeah.
Anything else about Zelda?
I mean, that's pretty much the main key points I wanted to start go through. One other thing is that it did have a second quest that you could play through if you named yourself Zelda, just with new dungeon locations, layouts, and all that stuff to allow for a more difficult playthrough.
If you name Link Zelda?
Yeah.
Maybe that's where all the confusion comes from. Like there's this constant perpetual joke about Link being called Zelda, or like the misunderstanding about who the protagonist in Zelda is. The protagonist is not Zelda. Zelda is the princess who you're saving.
Oh, and one other point, the name of the princess was inspired by Zelda Fitzgerald, the wife of the famous novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Oh, interesting. I wonder how they got on that. Japanese game designers.
He just thought she was really beautiful and liked his writing, so he wanted...
You know, Robin Williams' daughter is named Zelda after Zelda.
What?
Yeah, Zelda Williams is Robin Williams' daughter, named after Zelda.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. So my first game is Metroid.
Ooh.
Is that on yours as well?
That's on my list.
All right, great. We have a match. Bing, bing, bing. First time both of us speaking the same game. So Metroid is the first game in the very long-lived Metroid series. It was released in August 1987 on 86 the NES.
86 in Japan.
86 in Japan, that's right. Yeah. It's an action-adventure game with an emphasis on exploration set in the planet Zeebs, where you play Samus Aran, a female protagonist, which was very notable at the time, one of the first female protagonists in any game.
I think it was the first female protagonist in any game.
So the game is about trying to capture the parasitic Metroid organism, which was stolen and weaponized by space pirates. And this is a really dark and brooding NES game. Most NES games kind of have this cheery, happy atmosphere, and Metroid really does not. It's kind of a it's kind of a pretty dark game. I mean, the music,
even the soundtrack, yeah.
The soundtrack in particular. Yeah, I got some interesting notes on the soundtrack. The music composition was made by Hirokazu Tanaka, who's nicknamed Hip.
I didn't know he was nicknamed Hip.
Yeah, it's Hirokazu Hip Tanaka. In his words, he tried to create the sound without any distinctions between music and sound effects.
And he was trying to go against popular game music at the time too, right?
Yeah, and the soundtrack for Metroid was not well received at the time by Nintendo because they considered it to be too dark.
I love it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's really aged very well. I mean, but at the time, I suppose, you know, games kind of had to be created under the idea that it's a happy, cheery, family kind of thing. At that time, there were no games which were dark or included the kind of themes that Metroid did. Now, obviously, there's a million games which have the entire spectrum of content.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that she's a girl. Now, most people didn't realize that you had to beat the game under a certain time limit, correct?
There were different endings, actually.
Yeah, varied endings depending on how much time it had taken you to beat it.
What was it, 5 hours?
5 hours.
Right, so what happens if you complete it within 5 hours?
She is not wearing her helmet.
Oh, she reveals herself to be a female protagonist.
Yeah, depending on how fast you beat it, she's wearing less clothing. The best ending or whatever is her wearing the Zero suit or whatever, her little bikini suit.
Right. And actually, I read that in the manual for the game, the protagonist is referred to as he.
Yeah.
So it's like a secret that it's a female underneath the armor. She's in body armor normally, so you can't tell the gender.
Well, that also might not. I don't even know if that's intentional. I mean, with how manuals were written back then, they might not have even realized that writing the manual. But yeah, it is definitely a secret.
I think they did. I think that this is a Nintendo developed and published game. I think that it was intentional.
Did you know that Metroid is a portmanteau of the words Metro and Android? Thought that was
no, but I could read the Japanese Metroido. Which I didn't know that it was referencing anything, but
I mean, it comes it certainly from English, has, though. So.
It certainly has Metro in the name.
Yeah
Android, I guess. Yeah, that makes sense. That's interesting. The game was designed by Yoshio Sakamoto, who also designed a ton of other Nintendo games, including Balloon Fight, Kid Icarus, both of those are on the NES Classic, and Donkey Kong Jr., and almost every game in the Metroid series. Still works at Nintendo, actually.
Wow. I think this genre, Metroidvania, comes from Metroid and Castlevania, but the NES Castlevania games don't really follow this. But with the Metroid, you know, you most ability-enhancing power-ups, such as like Starman and Super Mario Bros. Or the Power Shot and Gauntlet, offered temporary boosts, but this is one of the first games to allow you to get permanent power-ups, and you have access to new areas to get through the game. So
yeah,
the
a big theme of this game and of the genre, which was pioneered by this game, was you would explore the world, And then you'd find all these places that were inaccessible. And then later in the game, you would acquire some kind of power-up or ability, and then you would retread your steps to go back to where you were and then access areas which were previously inaccessible, like the ball power-up thing,
yeah,
where you can like roll up into the ball morph and like ball. Roll around. Yeah, the morph ball, exactly, which has been a persistent theme in all Metroid games.
So I don't know if you played it, but it was reimagined as Metroid Zero Mission on the GBA, and this is, I think, the way that a remake of a game should be done. It really drastically, obviously, upgraded the graphics. It had a more developed backstory.
So it's like the original game?
It's like the original game on GBA with drastically updated graphics. There is a more developed backstory because the NES one did not delve too deep into the story. But with this one, they allow it to tie into the other Metroid games. And
did you ever finish this game?
I finished Zero Mission. I never finished the original one.
I never finished this one. Yeah, this was a really difficult game. In general, all these games are really tough games. The NES is probably the most difficult console, I think, of them all.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure.
Nintendo Power ranked Metroid 11th on their list of the best video games ever made on a Nintendo console. So it's regarded as one of the best Nintendo games of all time. That's obviously going back 30 years of Nintendo consoles.
It was ranked 7th by Game Informer in a top 100 list and 69th in EGM.
Yeah, I mean, aside from being a really great game on its own, it's just been so incredibly influential.
Absolutely.
And this is the prequel to Super Metroid on the Super Nintendo, which is considered one of the best games of all time.
Yeah, that is on like possibly my top 50 for sure, maybe top 25. All right, next on my list is Kirby's Adventure.
Nice.
I think it is such an adorable, charming game. I love the story and the plot, going to fight Nightmare, the kind of rivalry between King Dedede and Kirby's Adventure.
This is the first Kirby game, right?
Nah, this is the third Kirby game. Kirby started out on Game Boy, actually, with Kirby's Dream Land. And this was the largest NES game ever made, coming out at a whopping 6 megabytes.
Wow, do you know when that came out?
1993.
That is very late.
Yeah, very late in the NES life cycle.
Yeah.
I remember the first time playing it, I was just blown away at the level of polish in it for an NES game, the art style and everything. Really love Kirby's copy ability. He's got 24 different abilities in the game. Sword, cutter, hammer, spark, stone, parasol. And it was the first game in the Kirby series to include mini games. It had a variety of super just fun, charming little mini
games. So for people who don't know, what is Kirby?
Kirby is an adorable little pink puffball, and he has the ability...
He almost looks like Jigglypuff. It's like a Pokemon.
Yeah, and he has the ability to suck up enemies, and he can either spit them out or he can eat them and take their abilities to use to unlock new areas of a map.
It's almost a little similar to how Yoshi used to be.
Yeah.
You know, Yoshi used to be like you could eat things and then gain new abilities.
Yeah. So the original Japanese commercial for Kirby's Adventure actually depicted the characters made of yarn, which could have been an inspiration for the later Kirby's Epic Yarn, which came out a few years ago. Another fun fact is the first letters of the world names, excluding the Fountain of Dreams, spell out Vibgyor, V-I-B-G-Y-O-R, which backwards is Roy G. Biv, which is a mnemonic used for remembering the colors of the rainbow. It's a reference to just the rainbow.
Oh, right. It's a Boards of Canada album as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Great album. Great album. So, I actually purchased this game later on my GBA. It was remade as, what was it? Kirby's Nightmare in Dreamland. And it had cooperative multiplayer with 2 to 4 players and 3 new mini games. And I think one of the cooler aspects of it is, to make it a little more challenging, Meta Knight is a playable character now, and you have to play through the game as a speedrun. If you don't beat it in a certain number of time, game over. So I love that game. Really charming.
Next on my list is DuckTales.
Yeah, another game recently remade.
Recently remade in 2013 on PC and consoles. DuckTales was remastered. So this is an action platformer released in 1989 based on the animated Disney show, which I was a huge fan of as a kid. I love this show. It was also my favorite comic. I don't know if you read the DuckTales comic.
Actually, I have. I had a bunch of my dad's old comics.
I went through a very brief comic period. Was not big into comics, but DuckTales is my favorite comic. The game is about Scrooge McDuck, who is the character in the comic book who is always swimming through his vault of money, or like surfing on waves of money. It's always like cartoonish depictions of like an incredibly greedy, like wealthy business magnate.
And if I remember, a pretty catchy theme song.
Yes, the show had a super catchy theme song. The game is about traveling to different destinations all around the world to collect treasure to become the world's richest duck.
Which is so, such an appealing title.
Yeah, it's one of the most ridiculous premises of a game that I can think of. The levels are African mines, the Amazon, the Himalayas, Transylvania, and then the last one is the moon.
And you could switch between different characters, right?
No.
No, okay.
No, you cannot. You can select any destination you want. So it's almost kind of like Mega Man. Like you can approach any level in any order you want, as opposed to just being a linear list.
That's cool. It's been a while since I played that one. That one almost made my list, but I haven't played it in forever.
It had some of the best music of the 8-bit era. Polygon, the website, cited the moon theme as the most famous piece of music from the title, with them and some others calling it the most perfect piece of 8-bit music ever written. And check that out. Maybe we can include that in the podcast. And there are some other ones which sound great, which are from the Transylvania and Himalayas stages, which are very memorable. So it's pretty well known for the music. And it's made by Yoshinori Takenaka, who is also the designer of Super Ghouls and Ghosts and Mega Man 4.
That's a good point to transition to my next one, Ghosts and Goblins.
Nice.
Oh, man. So Ghosts and Goblins, the franchise, was created by maybe you can say his name. Your Japanese is better than mine.
Tokuro Fujiwara.
And he was known for producing games in the Mega Man franchise as well. So this game kicked my ass as a child.
Yeah, super hard game.
One of the hardest.
Ghosts and Goblins, is that right?
Yeah.
Later it changed to Ghouls and Ghosts?
Nah, I mean, Ghouls and Ghosts was, I believe, the second one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then there's Super Ghosts and Goblins and all this stuff. But anyways, the music developed for the first game level entitled Graveyard, Forest, and Ice Palace has since become recognized as the official theme for the franchise and has appeared on games Mega Man 7 and Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3. It stands as Capcom's 8th best-selling game franchise, having sold over 4.4 million units, and one of the most what-the-fuck moments in probably any game for such a challenging game is that when you beat the game, the devil is revealed to the final room is just a dream, and you are sent back to the beginning of the game and have to beat the game again.
Spoiler alert.
Within a time limit. It's all over the internet for everyone, so it's been out there for more than 25 years. If you don't know that,
I didn't.
Shame on you.
I don't know anybody who's beat that game. I doubt you do,
I've
right?
not beaten it. I don't know.
Do you
anyone.
Even know
no.
anybody who this
I
is like,
can't even get past like the third or fourth level.
Yeah,
dude.
This is like one of the most stupidly difficult games. But I mean, really fun. The Super Nintendo one was also just incredibly difficult.
Yeah, but I mean, just to think that for such a challenging game to do that to players and show you that you have to do it again is kind of unbelievable. But great game, and as you know, I love challenging games, so that's why that one makes my list.
Next on my list is Spy Hunter.
Oh, man, how could I forget? That is such a great game, and the Peter Gunn track.
The Peter Gunn track, that's right. This is an overhead view vehicular combat game developed by Bally and released on the NES in February of 1992. So this is also a very late stage NES game. Designed by George Gomez, who designed the Tron game, and he's a very notable pinball game designer. Made pinball games for Transformers, Batman, The Sopranos and Johnny Mnemonic. Little known Keanu Reeves movie, kind of The Matrix-like. The game drew inspiration from the James Bond films and was originally supposed to carry the James Bond license.
Wow.
Yeah, but they couldn't get the license, and so they didn't use a license. but the game included the soundtrack, or the theme song rather, from a TV show called Peter Gunn, which is the Grammy Award-winning Peter Gunn theme. From a TV show of the same name, which I've never seen the TV show.
Never seen it either.
But that song.
But I love that song.
Yeah, that is like an amazing song. I think that for people who've played Spy Hunter, one of the most memorable things has to be the music. It's a really good game. The game was designed on a piece of paper originally. It's a very simple game, easy to understand. And it was remade in 2001 on PlayStation 2, Xbox, and GameCube.
Have you played that one?
Yeah, it's good.
It's good. It's pretty fun, man.
Yeah, you got a car which turns into a boat and stuff like that.
Yeah, it was really, really, really nice reimagining of the series, I think.
There were some really interesting kind of trivia questions this game, which I found when I started reading about it. This one I didn't know. A version of Spy Hunter is included as an Easter egg in the first release of Microsoft Excel 2000.
What?
Yeah.
What? Did you look at pictures of that?
They included Spy Hunter in Microsoft Excel? Yeah. It requires DirectX to work. And shortly after Excel 2000's release, Microsoft officially banned Easter eggs from its non-game software.
Wow. That is awesome, though.
That is so awesome. Microsoft saw Spy Hunter in Excel, and they were like, no more Easter eggs in non-game software. That is just such a good story. What a great game for them to pick.
Yeah, really, really cool.
In the mid-2000s, around the time, actually a couple years after they did a remake, they were working on a movie about Spy Hunter. And the movie was to star Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
I remember that.
Yeah.
What happened with that?
It got stuck in development hell and eventually got canceled. But at one point, they had The Rock sign on to star in the movie, and they had director John Woo sign on to direct the movie.
Oh, man, that could have been awesome.
You know, hearing The Rock in the mid-2000s does not inspire confidence.
No, that doesn't,
because
but
now,
John Woo does.
Yeah, John Woo does, right.
Yeah, no.
So that could have been cool, but that never happened. He was in the Doom movie. You ever see that?
No.
Don't see it.
Yeah, I'm not.
But The Rock starred in the Doom movie, which was really, really bad. I think at that time.
I did hear that there's a first person segment of that, though, that I heard was pretty well done. But that's like, what, 15 to 30 seconds or something.
Yeah.
I can watch that on YouTube. All right. Next on my list, which this could possibly be your final title. I don't know. Mario Bros. 3.
Nope.
Aw, man. Well, I think I spent a lot of time with Mario Bros. Out of, you know, the early titles, I think Mario Bros. 3 was one of the most monumental. It's such an improvement over the original. The original pales in comparison to it. And
I mean, I think when you talk about, like, objectively the best, probably
Super Mario
3 is probably the one that's going to come out on top.
Yeah. I mean, it laid the foundation for so many of the future Mario games, and they're given a wide range of abilities in that game, with the ability to turn into just different things, the Tanuki suit, the raccoon suit. The Tanuki suit basically gave him the ground pound that became a normal iconic move for him. And it was, I've not seen this movie. You've talked to me about it. Part of its commercial success was due to it.
The Wizard.
Yeah.
How could you not have seen that movie?
Come on. You know how I am with movies. I just don't watch anything that I'm supposed to.
Man, you just missed a straight up classic. Like, the best time to see it is like surely as a child, because the movie is like awe inspiring in like how they make games look cool. You know, like in the movie, it depicts, and it's starring Christian Slater. I mean, it's got some really well-known people in it. And it's got the Power Glove in it. And Super Mario Bros. 3 is like a major thing in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I think, before its U.S. release, correct? So it was kind of a sneak peek. It was a sneak peek.
It was absolutely a sneak peek.
A big promo for Nintendo, basically.
Right. Anticipation for Mario 3 was at fever pitch level. And then the movie came out, and it's starring a lot of big 80s actors. And the movie itself is about a game competition. It's about a national video game competition. And it's about kids taking a road trip across the country to compete in this competition. And the competition includes Mario 3. And so it shows Mario 3. It specifically shows the whistle, the warp whistle.
The warp whistle.
Yeah. And it's just a really, really funny movie. I think if you watch it now, you'll really enjoy it.
I will watch it. It was developed by Nintendo Entertainment Analysis and Development, and to give a idea of the contrast of today's games development teams to back then, it was just over 10 people working on the game for more than 2 years to complete.
Ten people, nice.
Yeah, not a huge development team, but a really well done game. I love the introduction of the large world map that became, you know, a big part of later games in the series. And actually, this one with Bowser's children being the enemies you're fighting against, the Koopalings, they were designed to be unique in appearance and personality, and Miyamoto based the characters on 7 of his programmers as a tribute to their work and efforts.
No kidding.
So he had some really weird-looking programmers.
That's interesting. So I can't even remember what the kids are like at this point, the Koopalings or whatever.
I mean, they're kind of goofy-looking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bunch of goofy programmers.
Yeah.
The last game on my list is Castlevania.
The first one?
The first one.
That is a great game.
I actually enjoy the second one, too, even though the second one is, like, widely panned.
The second one is
Simon's Quest.
Right?
Yeah, second the last Simon's
the
Quest.
Third one is Dracula's Curse, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah. All really great games, though. The first one, I think, is one of the best platforming experiences you can have on the NES, for sure.
Yeah, the first one created the Castlevania series, which is a dark fantasy-themed action-adventure game created by Konami and released in 1986. So it's a pretty early NES game. It's about, the series in general is about the Belmont family, a clan of vampire hunters, and their fight with Dracula. And Castlevania is a name of Dracula's demonic castle. So you basically spend the game, it's a side scroller, you're going from left to right through different scenes in the castle, fighting all these kind of demonic monsters and zombies and things like this.
Really, really great game. And like I said before the series turned into what it is today with the emphasis on exploration, it was just really well done and refined platforming.
You know, I think what Castlevania really did was just lay the foundation, which eventually Castlevania Symphony of the Night built upon.
Yeah.
And that is a PlayStation game, generally regarded as one of the best games of all time,
yeah,
along with Super Metroid. And for that reason, Symphony of the Night just overshadows the original Castlevania, or really any of the other Castlevania games. So you don't see Castlevania that much on a list of like
pre-Symphony of the Night. You don't see a lot of mention of like Super Castlevania 4, which is a great game.
Oh, I love that game. One of my favorite SNES games because I got such good memories with that one. Yeah. But Castlevania really laid the foundation for it, and it's a really good game. Really holds up. I was playing it recently.
Yeah.
Really difficult game, but a lot of fun. Really one of the best ones on NES. One of my favorites.
Yeah.
We've gone through all of our 5, and I'm left with a list of bullet points, which, similar to our last podcast where we talked about our favorite indie games, are the other ones, my other favorite NES games.
Yeah. I'm going to go through my bullet point list real quick. One of the first ones was Excitebike. Love that game. Notable, I think, for at the time, for having a track editor. Really, really monumental at the time. As well as Battletoads. Reason that didn't make my list is just for its ridiculously unforgivable nature of difficulty.
Difficulty, yeah.
Ninja Gaiden, great, great classic game. And Mega Man 3.
Nice. I've got Contra. I came so close to picking that one. Yeah. Contra is like, I've played that so many times.
Great.
I don't even know how many hours played that as a kid. Mario 3, Mario 2. I love Mario 2 because that's like a super
quirky, weird.
Yeah, it's the really wacky outlier Mario game. It includes all these things like pulling up plants,
turnips.
Yeah, like yeah. all these weird things. It was originally not supposed to be a Mario game.
Yeah,
and then later it was changed to a Mario game. So there's a funny story behind that one. Mike Tyson's Punch Out,
great.
RC Pro Am, Duck Hunt, Rad Racer, which has got a great depiction in The Wizard. Dr. Mario, Mega Man, the original one. Although I think Mega Man 2 is often regarded as the best one.
Three,
really?
Yeah.
Okay. Bionic Commando.
That's a cool one.
Yeah, I really like that one was remade.
Yeah, that was remade really well, too.
And Dragon Warrior.
Never played it, but it's a classic.
Oh, and I did not list my fifth one.
Huh?
Yeah, I think I did Metroid, DuckTales, Spy Hunter, and Castlevania.
I thought we shared one.
We did. We did share one. My fifth one is Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Oh, okay.
yeah, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, one of my favorite games as a kid. This game came out in 1987, and it was originally made in Japan, and the president of Nintendo went to a boxing match where Mike Tyson was fighting. And was so impressed by Mike Tyson that he thought we should license this guy to put him in our game. So they did that, and they signed a 3-year agreement where he was reportedly paid $500,000 to put his name on this game. And it became one of the greatest NES games of all time. You fight through 14 different boxers, including all these iconic people. Bald Bull, Joe Glass, the first one?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Sandman. Just a really unforgettable
really
cast.
Quirky names and stuff. And I think such a different fighting game from what was on the system with things like Kung Fu.
Yeah, not a fighting game. A boxing game.
Yeah, but boxing
game. It was actually one of the reasons why this game has been much loved, I think, is because it's so unrealistic. It doesn't even try to be realistic at all. It's like completely ridiculous. Your character, you play as Little Mac, which
love
is
Lil Mac.
This like tiny, like almost midget-looking guy.
One of the coolest additions to the Smash Bros. Roster.
That's right. He was later included as a Smash Brothers character, Little Mac. And this game is really fun. It's held up very well, and it's included on the NES Classic, but it's just titled Punch-Out, so it does not include Mike Tyson. Yeah, because the Mike Tyson licensing deal has expired. And in 2014, Mike Tyson went on The Tonight Show and played Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. And played Mike Tyson in the game and got TKO'd in the first round, lost. Which, of course, is going to happen because the game is really difficult as you get to those higher stages. I remember as you get to Mr. Sandman, as you get to Mike Tyson, it gets super hard. And really, the game is all about pattern recognition.
Yeah.
You know, it's remembering how the boxers move and then internalizing that pattern and then, you know, breaking it down that way. And as you get to the later stages of the game, really difficult.
Cool. Are you playing anything else right now? You done with Darkest Dungeon yet?
No, I'm not done with Darkest Dungeon. That game takes a really long time. In the later stages, it's very grindy. So I'm spending a lot of time just basically having my guys get killed.
Do you think it's getting a little tiring at this point of the game? Or?
This is the time of the game where I've heard that a lot of people drop off.
Still committed to it, though?
Yeah. I've put in a lot of time, 25 hours, something like that, so I feel like there's no going back. I've gone too far into the dungeon to not see it through. But I have been playing Inside. I just finished Inside, developed by Playdead.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of fun. Short game, finished it in 2 sittings. It was cited by a lot of award organizations as the best game of 2016. Nominated for a number of those, and I can see why. It's a really fantastic kind of art as games game.
I mean, what I played of it, they built off of Limbo, and just the fluid animations in that are so, it's just really beautiful to watch.
Super good looking game.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
I not really playing much. I've been so busy this week. I'm probably going to be getting into, I downloaded a bunch of ROMs just this week. I kind of want to go and start playing some NES games.
Which ones would you get to first?
I'm going to play Batman.
Batman.
Yeah, dude, I looked it up and it looks like an awesome platformer for the NES, and he's got a wall jump, which just looks totally badass. It's crazy to think that that's like a game-changing mechanic.
It does. That does seem like a strange, a peculiar thing to latch onto as the reason for playing the game. But
cool, the art style and everything though looks like really great for an NES game. And talking about all this got me real nostalgic. So I want to go back and revisit some old games right now.
Based on the kind of Tim Burton, Jack Nicholson,
Batman,
the really good Batman. Great. Well, thank you for listening to the podcast. You can check out our previous two episodes on our website at chundugaming.com. If you search for the podcast in iTunes or Stitcher, it should come up there. If you have a moment and would be so kind to leave us a review on iTunes, we'd really appreciate that. And we will see you next time.
Later.